then made possible many of the things that you see here today. Because you have to start with an idea that something is possible. Maybe it's a challenge, it's an idea, it's a dream. And so he had this idea, maybe it could be possible, and he tried it and succeeded. The challenge was to emulate the Amiga, which until like, you know, a few years ago, when the Amiga was emulating everything. It was emulating Atari. Well, the CPU did not need to be emulated anyway, but there were not custom chips to be emulated. So it was easily running Atari OS, Mac OS, and so on. And all the Amigans said, ah, you see, we can do this, and nobody will ever be able to emulate the Amiga. And instead, then came the end, and the rest is history. Now you have Amiga on all operating systems, on a little chip, and so on. Of course, technology evolved, but somebody had to do it first. So, Bernd Schmidt, thank you for coming.
Okay. And hi, everyone. I have to admit, I'm not quite as well prepared as my predecessor. Michael told me about a week ago that he wanted me to talk here, and I was hoping to make a presentation, but didn't really have the time, so I'll just stand here and chat a little bit about the past, really. So if you all go back, let's say 12 years to the year 1994, that's about when the Amiga's future started to look not quite as bright as it had been, and people were buying 486 PCs, Pentium PCs, and they thought, well, I have this very powerful machine, it should be able to emulate an Amiga. So the Usenet discussion forums were pretty much filled with discussion about are any Amiga emulators available, is it possible at all? Now, there were two well-known hoaxes around at the time. There was a DOS program which contained one Kickstart 1.2 ROM and an image which we saw of the Kickstart holding the workbench hand. And it would just display that image, and people would think that it was an Amiga emulator, but sadly it wasn't. It was just a JPEG viewer. And the other hoax was just a screenshot of a program allegedly running on Next Step. It was called an nxamiga.gif, and it had all these features. It was apparently written by some well-known figure in the emulation scene, but that also was a hoax, unfortunately. So consensus in all those discussion groups at the time was that Amiga emulation was impossible. And some people had technical reasons for believing that. They thought, well, there has to be a mapping between hardware features. So you have to emulate the 68K with an Intel processor. You have to emulate Paula with, well, an Adlib or a Sound Blaster card. But what do you do about things like the Copper or the Blitter, which don't really have any kind of match in the PC hardware? So those were the technical reasons giving for why an Amiga emulation would be impossible. And others just took it on faith, more or less. They had some sort of mystical attachment to the Amiga. It was clearly better than any PC, so no PC could ever emulate it. I had already written an emulator for my first computer at the time, which was an Amstrad CPC. And now that I had some reasonably fast PCs for the time, I was thinking about, well, an Amiga emulator should be doable in theory. I knew the Amiga hardware quite well. I had written some small, not very good by today's standards, demos on them. And, well, I spent a lot of time researching, trying to decode the 68K instruction format, reading up on the aspects of the hardware that I wasn't very familiar with. I mean, there's lots of stuff to emulate. There's not just the well-known things like the Copper, the Blitter. There's also timers, keyboard controllers, mouse controllers, things you normally avoid having anything to do with if you can. So once I had spent a lot of time just figuring things out, I had an idea in my head how to do it. Obviously, features like the Copper and the Blitter all had to be emulated in software because there was no direct PC equivalent. So I wrote down what my idea of how it should look like was, and I ended up with a system that could boot up to the point where we got that image which we saw earlier of the hand holding the disk, only in black and white because I hadn't bothered to implement colors yet. and at that point it stalled slightly. I had implemented floppy disk emulation using disk files, but there were some glitches in there and it couldn't boot, and I didn't really have the time to do anything with it, so at some point I just decided to upload it somewhere, and I posted an announcement of the unusable Amiga emulator. And it was unusable, first of all, because it couldn't boot, and B, because it was terribly slow. In my first announcement, I think I estimated it would take an Intel 800 MHz Octium or something. And although I never really expected to see such a thing, it was more or less an accurate estimate. And one thing I decided pretty early was that I wanted the program to be open source. That was kind of new for me at the time. I had made parts of my earlier CPC emulator public as well, but it can be kind of scary to make a program open source. People get to see your rubbish code, and some people also are afraid that other people might steal your ideas or something like that. But UAE only became what it was because it was open source, and open source right from the start. After I made a second release, which could then boot into floppy disks and could run a few programs like Workbench and a couple of demos, there was a steady trickle of contributions from other people. It started slowly. At first, people just contributed key maps for French keyboards, Swedish keyboards, whatever they had lying around. But the contributions grew bigger over time, and pretty soon, the first major feature which came from somebody else was from Ed Hanway, who worked at Kodak, and apparently he had also started writing an Amiga emulator. He was going to just implement the operating system, so a slightly different approach there. That never really went anywhere, but he proposed that he could implement file system emulation so that you could access the native hard disk as an Amiga file system. And he got that running in about a week, so I looked at that, thought, cool, and I added that. It was around version 0.3 or 0.4, I can't quite remember. Then a nice friendly Italian chap named Alessandro Bisacco came along, and he had some ideas how to speed up the playfield emulation. In version 0.1, what I had was really stupid. It just drew every single pixel with a function call into the X11 libraries, so that was really slow. I had since then improved it a bit to draw line-wise into buffers and then draw the entire line to the screen. But Alessandro had the idea that, well, if you just look at a Workbench image, it's pretty static. It doesn't change a lot. Maybe if you move the mouse, a couple of lines will change around there. But you don't have to redraw the screen every time. So if you just keep around information for every single line where in memory the data is, then if you can determine whether any of that data changed, you can avoid redrawing those lines. And that was the basic idea, and that gave us a massive speed up for certain programs, even some games. And that's when Amiga 500 speeds became possible for certain programs on my Pentium 90. So it was quite impressive at the time. Of course, if you had a demo where a lot of was going on with copper effects, blitter effects, we were still nowhere where we needed to be. But the hardware at the time wasn't up for it, but nobody says you can't plan for the future when you have faster hardware. So that Alessandro also did a couple of other things, like confining the mouse pointer nicely to the Amiga window. But like Ed Hanway, he also then disappeared again, never to be heard from again. Another big contribution which we had was from Brian King, who worked for Michael for a while, and he implemented Picasso support, which allows us to not just use the Amiga's native resolutions, which are in the custom hardware, like PAL and NTSC, and which aren't really all that high resolution, but to pretend to the emulated Amiga that it has a graphics card. So you can use more or less the entire area of your native display. And it's also a bit faster than having to go through the emulation of all those hardware registers. So that's what Brian did. I think there was one other contribution which I wanted to point out. I can't quite remember it now. Of course, there were ports to other architectures. I had only written it for Unix when I started. My first emulator was, the CPC emulator was an assembly program written for DOS, and obviously that was never going to fly for an Amiga emulator because it was just too complex. Well, that's what I thought, although Peter Schau proved me wrong with his fellow. But since it was written in C and relatively portably, people started submitting ports. There was Ernest Socorbi, an Argentinian, I believe, who wrote a Mac port. Olaf Bartel wrote an Amiga port, so the thing could run itself. And obviously, there were a couple of Windows ports. Michael Ortmann and Brian King worked on those in the early days. So, over time, things just... Mostly other people added the features. I was originally, and I still am really, only interested in Amiga 500 emulation because that's what I had. I never really had any of the newer Amigas. And my goal was to preserve some of the old software which I had, which was mostly games. It wasn't necessarily written because of lemmings, like in your case. For me, it was mostly Turrican, really. So, people started also submitting things like 68020 support, which I think was Christian Bauer. I could be wrong here. And 68881 support for the FPU. Gustavo Goeders submitted a port to Microsoft DOS, which was still around and somewhat important back then. So really, the project grew because it was open source and lots of people downloaded it, lots of people played with it and implemented what they wanted to see in an Amiga emulation. And now that I have somewhat retired from the project, it's still going strong because Tony Whelan took over. He's doing the Windows version and he's still adding features and improvements to the software. Of course, sometimes open sourcing a program can also cause problems because sometimes somebody will come along who has completely different ideas and personalities can clash. There was Samuel De Vulder, who was a very bright guy and helped a lot with the custom chip emulation, getting it more accurate, but he also wanted to rewrite the entire thing. And he did, and some of his code was really quite good, but I never really could convince myself to implement it because I didn't understand it quite as well as the stuff I had written. Probably nobody else understood the stuff I had written, but as long as I was still working on the program, it was important to me that I could understand it. And so sometimes if you submit something to an open source project, it can end in a disappointment because your ideas aren't necessarily taken up. In the end, though, I think it almost had too much success because if you look at the C64 scene, there's lots of emulators. There was PC64, C64S, there was Vice, Christian Bauer's Fodo, and lots of competing models, lots of different ideas how to implement a C64 emulator, and that never really happened in the Amiga scene. There was Fellow, which works quite well, but it's also not quite as ambitious as UAE ever was. So maybe having one emulator which everyone could work on kind of took away the possibility for competition, which might have improved things even more. So that's basically all I had to say about the history. Not sure anybody, whether I should go into technical details or if anybody has questions. I really wish I had brought something to demonstrate. I had an old version of version 0.1 lying around, which was quite interesting. It had some of the nice graphical glitches that you also experienced. But I didn't really get around to preparing very much. So, if there are no questions...
Yeah, some technical details maybe. I would like to know if your very first version, if you had thought about demo coders and all these games that, that use the fact that the 68000 processor runs at a fixed speed compared to the chipset. So, if you're writing certain code that... That uses the chipset in a way that it's not documented. For example, if you're writing into the blipper, you're doing some blips, and you do not wait for the blipper to be finished. You just expect it to be finished at this very cycle, and you trigger it earlier than you are supposed to. Did you have that in mind?
I did have that in mind. As I said, the program was written as an Amiga 500 emulator, and I wanted to run games and demos primarily. The problem you mentioned about the blitter may be starting too early because somebody writes blitz size before the blitter has finished. Yes, I did have that in mind, and what I actually did was whenever blitz size is written, the current blit, if any is still in progress, is just finished right there and then before the new one is started. I cheated. Well, at that point, I wasn't planning to do things in a cycle accurate fashion, because I knew very well that even a Pentium 90, which was a fast machine at the time, was way too slow to emulate an Amiga cycle for cycle. You just couldn't do it. Well, you could do it, but the speed would kind of suck. So what I tried to do was get the copper more or less right on a line-by-line basis. The first versions didn't do any kinds of copper plasmas where you change colors or anything in the middle of a line. That came later. We have a cycle-accurate copper emulation now, which also handles color changes and several other tricks in the middle of a line. But that wasn't in the first versions. I wanted to have it, but for the moment it seemed better just to do a rough draft, really. The first versions really were a draft. Everything was written very quickly just to get something working or sort of working, so you could boot into a workbench or maybe a simple game. And there's an old software engineering proverb which says, prepare to throw one away, you will anyhow. Which means that you should expect that the first version of a program you write is going to be completely rewritten. It's going to be a prototype, you're going to learn from it, and then you're going to redo it in a proper way. And that's exactly what happened. One of the first things which got thrown out was the first version of the CPU emulation, which got completely replaced by something faster. Although there wasn't really a need for it, probably that time would have been better spent on other features.
The other question would be for emulation in general, because the Amiga chipset handles not only graphics, but also sound. And one problem that any version of the Amiga emulation has is that sound and video is never really properly aligned. And do you see a way around that?
Well, that's mostly due to buffering. You prepare one frame of video to draw, and then you blit it to your screen, and that happens more or less. It doesn't have a perceptible delay, but sound is buffered up to, well, maybe. It really depends on how fast your machine is, how often you want to call into the sound driver. If you have a really large buffer, then it's a pretty efficient sound emulation, but it also, the length of the buffer also causes a delay. because you write into it sample by sample, and once it's full you start playing it, so you have that many samples delay. And if you have a fast machine or an efficient sound driver, you can make the buffer smaller, and then you don't have this perceptible lag anymore. But yes, it's quite a common problem in these real-time applications.
So the only solution to that would be better hardware.
Better software, possibly. Operating systems.
Okay.
Especially with the Windows port, I've had all sorts of trouble with the sound emulation. First versions never really worked for me. I tried to implement direct sound support, and that never worked for me. It seems to be mostly up and running now, but there are better ways to come up with a sound driver API than what Windows did. I implemented a small 68K debugger right from the start, which I could use to single step through any program I chose to run. And there's also system level debuggers like GDB, which you can use to debug the source code itself. And then it's just, like debugging always is you step through the thing and try to figure out, well, this is not what should happen just at this point, and why is that happening? Certainly I had my Amiga 500 sitting next to me, and I would sometimes write test programs trying to figure out what they would do for timing issues, certainly. I had this demo core which I modified to just use different copper timings, different amounts of bit planes, just trying to figure out what the timing was. And yes, also trying to figure out the effects of certain 68K instructions which weren't fully documented. So yes, obviously I used my real Amiga for that. There were a couple of, I just remembered a couple more contributions people had. Of course, there was Bernie Meyer, who implemented the JIT compiler. I had started on a project like that, but abandoned it because the conclusion I had was that it doesn't really fit in well with an Amiga emulator. It's great for something like a Mac where you don't have hardware accesses all the time, but if you want to trap accesses to the hardware registers and also keep compatible with the 68K instruction set, there are some of these features don't really play well with each other. You really want to have the chipset emulation running more or less in real time, also for issues like the sound issue you mentioned. And if you want maximum CPU speed, then you want to have the CPU emulation running uninterrupted as long as possible. So these goals kind of contradict each other, and there's really two types of emulator users. There's the crowd which just wants to play Amiga 500 games and run the demos. And that I'm part of that crowd. And I really just want a 68K emulation as accurate as possible, as timing accurate as possible. And it doesn't really have to run any applications under the workbench. It certainly doesn't have to run Quake, because if I want to play Quake, I do it on my PC. But there are other people who just want to run the workbench in a high resolution with a very fast 68K CPU and running Amiga applications, even if they're just ported from the PC. So there's two different types of users, and there's also different differences in how to best support these users. You can't really have one emulation covering everything. You have to at least have a way to switch off or turn on certain features depending on the user. And that sometimes makes the emulation hard to configure and hard, maybe difficult to use, because there are just so many switches. And that's a real problem, I think. But no way around it. There's lots of projects which never really took off. There were attempts to implement parts of the Amiga libraries, the graphics library, or even exec natively. So you have lots of code which allows you to call into native code and even have some sort of task switching. But that never really went anywhere because emulated 68K code is plenty fast enough now. So you don't really need that kind of complexity and possible compatibility issues.
I'm not sure whether you said it right at the beginning of your talk, but what does the machine just stop developing?
The PC, you mean? I don't remember. Let me think. I bought a 386 in 93, I bought a 486 in 94, and I bought a Pentium in 95. So
when did you really start?
It might have been still the 486.
Megahertz.
So that was fast enough to run a CPC emulation, pretty cycle accurate, and that should tell you that if you're trying to emulate an Amiga in a cycle accurate way, it's never going to fly. Not on that machine. AROS is doing just that. I looked into that a while ago, years ago. I was talking to these guys. I think both of us really noticed that the AROS code wasn't really usable. I think there were endianness issues, and AROS really assumed that it was an operating system and not running inside some kind of emulation, because if you're an operating system, you directly control all the resources. You can use direct pointers. You don't have to go through all these indirections that the emulator code has to use to access Amiga memory. And so it would take a lot of effort just to get AROS running on the Amiga, and kind of what's the point, really?
Yeah. No, more the point of integrating the emulator into AROS, so the native chipset support. But probably means rewriting.
That also would require some kind of interface between the emulator and AROS. Of course, you could just do it as a regular port, like Olaf Bartel's Amiga OS port. And that would be fun. It's hard to come up with a good interface. So, anything else? No? Okay. Thank you all.